You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on September 14th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Persephone joined me to discuss how institutions from the NFL to colleges should handle assault allegations. Then we debate President Obama's new policy on Syria and ISIS. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
And joining me on the line from Michigan is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back.
Thank you.
This week, we're going to talk about a couple of different stories, the first being the NFL and some of the politics and legalities surrounding that in recent weeks. Then we're going to be looking at the situation in Syria with regard to President Obama's new policy. We're going to try to cover some new territory that we haven't already discussed on previous episodes. So, Nate, we're going to start with the NFL situation. Unfortunately, Greg couldn't be here this week because he would have wanted to talk about this as well. But you're going to walk us through some of what's been happening. And, you know, I know I've got various questions, and I'm sure Persephone does as well. And then, you know, I think we're going to talk a little bit about some of the wider issues that are at play here, too. And we should probably warn people also for this segment that there's going to be a lot of discussion of domestic violence incidents and other things in you know, a described form. So just people should be prepared for that. So what exactly has been going on with the NFL right now?
Yeah, Bill. I mean, I think this has pretty much been the darkest week and the week that makes the NFL look the least credible since we found out that Aaron Hernandez had a penchant for PCP blunts and drive-bys. You know, that was something that happened very close around here, so we're all very familiar with it. But basically, this week, the NFL got completely exposed as lying scumbags, basically. You know, the commissioner was caught lying on national television, it looks like. Situations surrounding their complete failure to punish domestic violence in the league. You have star running backs coming out that they're knocking out their wives, whipping their children with tree branches. You know, just awful, awful things. And there's been a bunch of cases that have really have not been handled properly by the NFL. And really, this all goes back to an incident in Atlantic City about 6 months ago where Ravens running back Ray Rice, he was out at the casino with his fiance, Janae Rice, Janae Palmer at the time. They got married the next day. But from the video footage that we've now been able to see, initially we just saw him dragging her out of the elevator. But it looks like he perhaps spit on her outside of the elevator, just really nasty stuff. She sort of pushes him. They go inside the elevator. He takes a jab at her, like in the ribs, I think. She pushes back, and then she comes at him, and he just completely swings a left hook to the side of her head, just completely catches her. She gets her head knocked into the metal railing and is just completely out. And, you know, he's like picking her up and trying to drag her out, get her out of the elevator and, you know, take her to the car or something. And gets caught, and, you know, everything is developed from there. But the situation back a couple weeks ago was that basically Janae Rice and Ray Rice, they married. They were trying to say all the things, well, we'll put this behind us, blah, blah, blah. And Ray Rice only gave a 2-game suspension. And that caused a pretty big outcry. This was around the time that star receiver Josh Gordon was suspended basically the entire year for failing a marijuana test. So that juxtaposition didn't serve the NFL well. But after that, things sort of died down a little bit. There was a new domestic violence policy introduced. So instead of just sort of arbitrary 2 games, blah, 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 decided by the commissioner, it was 6 games for the first offense and then an entire year for the second offense. So it seems like, you know, maybe things are getting back on the rails a little bit, Bill, but pretty much as we've seen this past week, things have completely gone up in smoke. TMZ released the in-elevator videotape. So this was not available to the public until very recently, but it showed as I described, Ray Rice just completely catching Jhené Rice with a punch, and this was described at the time, punch like he would punch a man. And this completely unraveled the web of lies that pretty much, it seemed like everyone was very willing to believe about how Jhené Rice played a part in this, and she was hitting him first. Oh, and he had to defend himself. I mean, what's he going to do? Just let her hit him? And everyone is just completely forgetting this is a small woman. I think she's under 5'5", going against a guy who's just all muscle. Running backs are some of, like, they take the most hits. They give out the most hits. They're pretty, pretty tough guys. And he just completely cold-cocked or decked her. It was sickening to watch, actually. So, did you see the video, Bill? You...
No, I didn't watch it.
Yeah, I mean, once I recommend it, it's not pleasant to watch.
And I think at this point we know the situation, and that's not really
right. This is my point, is that we knew all the details of what happened in the elevator. In fact, it's come out that Ray Rice told Commissioner Goodell, in fact, what happened in the elevator. But in the past couple of days, Goodell, he tried to give some sort of interview where he was excusing his actions, simultaneously saying we didn't need to see what was on the tape, but while actually saying, we did need to see what was on the tapes to suspend him more than 2 games.
And so again, as Nate said, Rice had admitted privately to the, you know, a leadership in the NFL what he had done without anyone actually seeing it.
To the Ravens people and as that as well. But I guess maybe he also tried to characterize a little bit as he was defending himself a bit more, because that's what everyone seemed very willing to believe. And that was sort of the story that was spun. And then it came out that, you know, that's not at all what happened. And I don't know, just people were very surprised and shocked by the video. And I was actually quite shocked that people were shocked, just because it felt like everyone, once again, was extremely willing to believe Rice's side of the story and not consider the fact that she's on the ground unconscious. How do you think she got like that? Do you think it was because she slipped and tripped and fell and hit her head? Or do you think it was because a giant running back cold-cocked her and just completely knocked her out? I mean, it was actually pretty disgusting to read a lot of comments surrounding this issue, whether it's online or anywhere else, basically excusing domestic violence and the fact that, you know, this situation happened, and basically people excusing it because, oh, he's on their fantasy team, or, oh, because the Ravens fans, or, oh, because they like the way he runs. It's just, it's absolutely disgusting. I'm at this point, I'm starting to get extremely fed up with the NFL because, you know, immediately after that Goodell interview, it comes out that actually the police had sent a copy to the NFL sort of by back channels, but they did get a copy, and the NFL employs ex-CIA, ex-FBI, all these guys that are a part of this alleged crack security team, and they couldn't get the footage, even through back channels. Goodell was trying to claim that, oh, it would have been illegal for us to get it from this district police department. Turns out that it actually wouldn't have been illegal, according to the district attorney's office in New Jersey. But, you know, that's an entirely separate legal issue that we won't really need to go down, because they saw the video. They lied about seeing the video. Someone saw the video in the NFL. That is a fact, because the AP report that came out had a clip of audio that was played for the reporter from an NFL landline saying, a female voice saying, yes, thanks for the video. We saw it. You're right. It's terrible. So they saw it. They knew how bad it was. And the only question now is what this so-called independent investigation, I'm using the scare quotes for Bill here, what this turns up. Because Robert Mueller, we know his long history of heading these independent investigations. I think there are some questions about his, not that he won't be independent, but, you know, he has some pretty serious ties to the law firm that's, you know, really represents a lot of these NFL athletes. The whole thing is being overseen by two owners. You know, you have owners coming out and saying that Goodell did a good job in handling this whole thing. And then, so that's sickening. Meanwhile, it comes out that, you know, pretty much everyone is doing something terrible in the league, because, you know, next thing you know, you've got Adrian Peterson beating a child with a tree branch. You know, his own son, I think it was 11 years old, just whipping him almost. You know, there were pictures from a week later where he's still pretty much bleeding. You have an incident with Greg Hardy, star defensive lineman for the Carolina Panthers, also known as the Kraken. He's not allowed to wear his Kraken face paint because of NFL rules, but he was allowed to play after he threatened to kill his girlfriend, was choking her, dragging her by the hair, throwing her into a stone or a tile bathtub, throwing her on a futon filled with guns, bruising her from head to toe. But he was allowed to play. So, you know, just you can't wear the face paint as long as he's allowed to play.
Now, there's a whole bunch of these cases, and we're going to get in a little bit into details about some of them. But I wanted to kind of stop for a moment and ask some questions about, you know, the handling of the Rice case, but more broadly, the NFL's handling. As you mentioned right there about the examples of, you know, not being able to wear face paint under the NFL rules and being punished for that. Or, you know, I think there's punishments for people who curse on the field and things like that or something. Yeah. And there's, you know, if
you're... You also can't say the N-word anymore.
Right. Field, and you know, drug offenses. And steroids and things like that, those all get punishments. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, this is something that we've heard a whole bunch of times. A lot of people are saying this is not a viewpoint that I agree with, but I want to ask you, you know, your response to this. Some people are saying, well, the NFL should be punishing things that are related to, you know, game violations and athletic violations, but it's not their job to be punishing people for, you know, these breaking the law things, these horrible violent offenses and stuff like that. Is this the job of the NFL? I happen to think it is, and we can get into that, but I want to get your perspective on this. Where does the NFL's role come into this in terms of applying punishments?
Right, and here's where this whole thing gets a little bit ironic and sad, is that Goodell originally came in as sort of the disciplinarian, the sheriff. His entire job is to, quote-unquote, protect the shield, the NFL symbol shield, and protect its reputation. But what that's morphed into is him trying to shield it from any and all bad public relations and prioritizing that over actually disciplining and punishing what's really necessary and to be punished. So in the case of all these domestic violence things, you know, Goodell had talked about holding up the NFL as like the shining symbol, and it seemed like he was willing to enforce his own version of morality on it. And if you're trying to talk about doing that, you have to punish people for domestic violence, because it doesn't get much worse than beating up a child or beating up your wife when they have no possibility to defend themselves. It's not like you're getting in a fight or a bar fight with another guy or something. That's bad enough. But, I mean, these kind of situations are so far beyond that, it's disgusting. So if someone beats up their child to where they're not, you know, the child is bleeding a week later, I'm sorry, they shouldn't play football. There are so many of these guys who have some sort of sketchy incident in their past. You know, it becomes very difficult to say, oh, okay, he did this, so therefore he should never play again. But if you have an incident like we saw with Adrian Peterson or Ray Rice, where they're clearly guilty of a pretty heinous crime, and just because the justice system hasn't processed it yet, that's what they always hide by. Oh, we got to wait for the justice system to sort it out. Well, Greg Hardy was, I believe, indicted, and then he... because of the appeals process, he's not going to jail at all. So therefore, he still gets to play. I mean, that's a sickening loophole. He's just because the entire process hasn't finished yet, he's clearly, you know, he's going to be convicted. I mean, they have the evidence, but because the process is ongoing, he can still play. I mean, I just feel like, no, it's not the entire NFL's job to enforce morality, and I wish they wouldn't do that as much, but at the same time, there are things that are just not acceptable. There's no right to play in the NFL. It's a privilege. And if you're doing things that are so disgusting that, you know, the entire nation is pretty much revolted by them, you shouldn't really be entitled to play football.
Right. And it seems like, you know, especially how we've seen so many people rallying to even people like Ray Rice. Or,
yeah,
you know,
there are a lot of Ravens fans that were very quick to defend Ray Rice and still do. And many of them women.
And you know, that it's a testament to the fact that the NFL and its players are still, for better or worse, held up on this pedestal as sort of role models and heroes and people to look up to. And you can say that's a bad idea, but that doesn't change the fact that that's how they are regarded currently. So if they're up on that pedestal, they've got to be held to a higher standard, and there has to be sanctions applied.
Exactly. And it's not like Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson were these two kind of not well-known running backs that maybe, you know, weren't particularly big media stars. These are probably... Adrian Peterson is one of the biggest stars in all of football, easily the top running back. And, you know, you had Ray Rice, who was Super Bowl champion, everyone was stand-up guy, anti-bullying, pretty much all this. So these two guys are, in many ways, the pillars of the NFL in terms of, you know, just sort of shining examples of, you know, of what to do. And they're the ones getting caught in these terrible situations. So, I don't know, that doesn't leave a ton of comfort that, you know, if these guys are getting caught doing terrible things, you know, can we really expect anyone else to be, you know, to be perfect? So I think we just, this is something that's been an issue in sports for a while, but you can't look up to these guys because you don't know them.
Right.
You don't know what kind of things they're doing off the field, whether it's drugs, whether it's violence, whether it's all sorts of other stuff. You know, you just watch them on the field, enjoy what they do on the field. It's a gladiator sport. It's a blood sport, football. You can't get attached to them otherwise because you don't know what they're doing.
And
I like Aaron Hernandez, too. I thought his throwing money celebration here was kind of cool. I liked all of his tats. And then, you know, turns out he likes the Glock 18, likes to, you know, do execution gangland-style killings if someone pisses him off.
I think that it's a really good point that you don't know these people. And also, the fact that somebody with so much of the public eye on them, you know, with a video published, circulating the internet, that shows them beating up, you know, another person, the fact that this can just go around and there are no repercussions, it really says something. And it lets, I mean, if this woman and this kid aren't having their rights defended when there's all this evidence, you know, millions of people are aware of this situation. It's like this huge thing. If they can't get help, then what does this say about the women all over the country and the men who are getting abused by spouses or by boyfriends and other people? You know, this is something that's happening all the time. And sure, this is a big, like, publicity thing, but I think it's important to remember that it's not like this is just, this doesn't only happen when we hear about it in the news.
Right.
This is something that's happening as we speak, you know, as we speak, there are people that are being abused. I would hope that something like this would draw attention to that, but instead what we're seeing is this powerful guy being just completely let off the hook because he's a big sports star and we don't want to mess with that, and he's bringing in the money.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Persephone. And in many ways, this whole situation in some ways speaks to the fact that domestic violence isn't taken all that seriously in some, you know, corners of the public discourse. Everyone seems to be, as I was saying, easy to believe that there was some exonerating situation that Ray Rice couldn't have possibly, you know, done something. Or, you know, in the past, there's only been 2-game suspension, 3 games maximum for domestic violence, whereas you have much longer suspensions for hitting guys in the head or drug policy violations, things like that.
Dog fighting rings,
exactly. Although, if you read out some of the details about Vic there, some of that stuff is pretty sick, too.
But it shouldn't be, you know.
Not to get completely sidetracked with that, but
there should be stronger punishes and sanctions for this domestic violence stuff. One thing that I wanted to also, this is another parallel that we can go down, and I think Persephone might have some thoughts on this as well. Nate, you mentioned about how part of the issue here is this idea that, you know, some of these guys are going to get punished eventually by the criminal justice system, almost, you know, certainly. We have the rock solid evidence. It just takes a while to sometimes process through all these things. And so the NFL's punishments, the argument for that is in some ways, well, there needs to be at least some interim punishment when the evidence is such a slam dunk that, the, you know, they have to be getting some, you know, losing some amount of money over this or being, you know, show that there are immediate consequences for this so that it's not an abstract, like, oh yeah, I remember that guy from like 5 years ago and that thing happened. Well, he just went to prison. Like there needs to be some instantaneous. And so that's, you know, an argument for the NFL getting involved, but clearly they haven't been doing that great of a job of that. So the other parallel that I want to bring up is similar situation that's been in, you know, in discussion a lot this year in particular is about sexual assault on college campuses, right? And this may, sometimes it has to do with, you know, college athletes, but a lot of times it doesn't. But however it happens, there's been a lot of, I would say, very well-founded criticisms that a lot of colleges are having their own separate processes for handling sexual assaults and are doing a pretty horrifically terrible job of doing that. Now, some people say this is an argument for, you know, taking it entirely away from the colleges and having it only in the legal system, not that the legal system handles it all that well either. And some people say, no, this is actually an argument for reforming how the colleges do it. And I'm actually not sure where to come down on that because I think the colleges, by and large, are handling it terribly. But on the other hand, similar to the NFL, you want to have some sort of interim measure so that even if it takes several years to go through the legal process or get that conviction, you don't want the alleged perpetrator you know, being on campus, potentially reoffending, potentially causing problems, you know, for the person that they've assaulted ongoing after the actual incident. Persephone, do you see a parallel here? Where do you think that these institutions need to be going in terms of handling things on a sort of interim internal basis while they wait for the legal system to process it?
I mean, if colleges can and do expel people for plagiarism, which, you know, is, you know, we had an honor code at my school, and a lot of schools have honor codes. And if you violated the honor code, you could be, you know, suspended or expelled. Given that, I really don't see why you wouldn't be able to suspend or expel somebody for sexual assault. I mean, we're talking about a solution that schools implement for a variety of other things that don't involve physical harm to another human being. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, I mean, colleges have the power to decide who is and isn't on their campus. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing and, oh, we don't want to be too harsh. Like, we can't do it without, like, you know, criminal evidence. Like, that's just completely made up. People get expelled for tons of things. This is completely in the power of these institutions. The same thing applies to the NFL. They have the power to terminate any employee they want, whenever they want, for anything other than, you know, something that violates federal law. So to say that they can't do this until they have more proof, I mean, no, I don't buy it.
Okay, so it sounds like Persephone coming down strongly there on saying that both the NFL and college campuses need to have a faster, more decisive internal system of justice to sort of complement or bridge the situation over to the legal side. I mean, that seems pretty reasonable to me. If they're, you know, ejecting people or punishing people for all these minor things, if there's reasonable suspicion that they've done something else, you know, and I think that's another distinction too, is like with a college or with the NFL, even if these guys are ultimately cleared of something, if there was reasonable suspicion, you know, to take it to trial or something or proceed with an investigation, you know, it's not the legal system. So shouldn't it be that we can have a lower bar of what we, you know, before we kick these people out of their organizations and stuff? Like, can we say, look, we don't know for sure what happened, but it seems like it's plausible that something definitely happened here. And, you know, I can see the argument of saying, oh, that's a slippery slope of, you know, just a witch hunt or whatever. But I honestly don't think that's as much of a problem as people seem to make it out to be. I think that in most cases, by the time it makes it to a formal accusation, the barriers are so high against bringing that accusation in the first place, whether it's, you know, from a survivor of domestic violence bringing it against their partner, or, you know, a sexual assault victim on campus bringing it against their accuser. By the time they've actually overcome all those hurdles to bring that accusation, that's a pretty reasonable suspicion there that something happened. And maybe you don't have all the details, but again, that's for the legal system to sort out, whereas the college or the NFL can say, based on the available details that we have, let's give this person the axe right now, just because it's better to be safe than sorry. Nate?
Right. Just in terms of the sexual assault thing, this is a very hot button issue at around the school. And there was certain processes set up, including like various panels involving students that can have a seat on like the disciplinary committee that investigates some of these things. So it's not, you know, completely just up to like one person or something like that. But I think the main problem that Goodell has for himself now is he appointed himself judge, jury, executioner, and he's basically finding out that once you screw up one of those sentences, everyone's going to be, you know, turning their eyes towards you. So, I mean, in the Ray Rice case and in just all these domestic violence cases, the problem is that there is not, and there was not, now there somewhat is, but there was not a clear, consistent guideline for punishing domestic violence. It was just sort of fly by the seat of their pants, is not a big deal, so, you know, let's just not really pay attention to it. If something happens that we can't ignore, two, three game suspensions were handed out. But you just had this amazing situation on ESPN the next day where you have this this guy Bill Polian, former GM of the Indianapolis Colts, basically going out there and saying that it's very troubling that a videotape could be sent to the NFL and then no one would get it. You know, this sort of thing doesn't happen at NFL headquarters. And then this was at about 10:47. At about 11, who's back on ESPN, another interview saying, oh, you know, just like any bureaucracy, stuff can be lost, and, you know, you hope that it's not sitting in someone's desk somewhere, and, you know, basically setting up whoever that woman was on the tape, whether it was an executive or, you know, an admin or someone, to basically saying, oh, she kept the tape. Oh, it's her fault. You know, blame the woman. Exactly. So it's getting pretty crazy over there, and you need a process. You need multiple a panel of different people examining this. You know, just because there's a, you know, a 911 call, police report, I'm not saying that just because of that situation, someone needs to be banned for the entire year. But I'm also saying, someone throws their fiance on a bed full of guns and bruises her from head to toe and chokes her, threatens to kill her, he should not be playing the next week. That's just a thought, maybe. Or, you know, this Ray McDonald situation, he, you know, the charges haven't completely been filled out there, and he claims, oh, it was a misunderstanding. Yeah, just like how, you know, Janae Rice slipped and hit her head. Exactly. Just a misunderstanding. And he's playing, so.
Yeah.
And Greg Hardy actually was inactive today, or deactivated, so he did not play today, but he played week one.
And, you know, just to reiterate, as Persephone said earlier, this is, let's remember, a much bigger issue than just these NFL players. You know, this domestic violence is not something limited to these high-profile people and whatever. They, you know, it can affect anyone in all sorts of relationships at all sorts of levels. There's all kinds of factors that, you know, trap people in those relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, people didn't seem to understand. They kept on trying to say, well, why did she stay with him? Or why did she marry Ray Rice? And it's like, that's not the question.
Yeah.
I mean, for all we know, he was, you know, saying that she was going to lose all this, you know, NFL money that he was getting, you know, that then she was going to be left, you know,
well,
broke
and
on the street.
How do we notice the first time you hit her?
Right. And
I mean, it's quite possibly not even close to the first time. So,
and there's just any number of reasons that are, you know,
like,
potentially
trapping her. Did you see
her
face during the interview?
So.
I watched some of the interview or the press conference she had with, or basically apologizing for her role in the situation. The Ravens trying to bail out Ray Rice, and, you know, just the look on her face, she looked so unhappy. It was, I mean, it just, the body language there is pretty incredible.
And when we've got football players like Aaron Hernandez who are going around killing people for accidentally spilling a drink on him at a club,
yeah,
you can imagine
don't
that,
spill any drinks on him.
That somebody, you know, would be afraid that their already abusive husband or fiance is going to come after them if they try to leave. So, you know, we need to strengthen protections again for women in this country in any situation, no matter who they're married to or in a relationship with or whatever their situation might be, to ensure that they're not getting endangered.
And just like, you know, this is very much a Watergate situation where the cover-up is, I won't say it's worse than the crime because hitting a woman is, but, you know, now we're basically seeing how there's an institutional level failure at the NFL to take domestic violence and view it as a serious crime that deserves punishment. And then you're finding out that people are lying to cover their ass about this situation. So not only does it look extremely insulting to the particulars of the situation, but NFL is dramatically trying to expand its revenue base, and they're appealing to a lot of female fans. And that's been something that's been growing over the past couple of years. Lots of merchandise directed at female fans.
And of course, many female fans, you know, there were lots of women who were NFL fans, but, you know, they weren't necessarily comfortable being in, you know, in the stadiums or being an active participant in supporting these things. And when you've got this kind of cover up going on at the highest levels and then fans still rallying to these people, I mean, that's a big, you know, giant neon sign that says women aren't welcome as fans of this sport.
And people were cheering for Ray Rice and chanting for him in Baltimore. That's awful. But the last thing I just kind of want to say, and then you maybe Persephone or Billy, if you want to add your comments to it, just there's something about this sport. It's not good. Like it's bad for you. It's bad for the people around you. It feels like, I mean, there was a report recently released, the New York Times report, saying the NFL had admitted that a third of its players will get CTE by the time they're 50. And there are a lot of cases involving CTE where actually that leads to domestic abuse because people are so screwed up in the head because they took so many shots when they were playing that, you know, they're lashing out at their family. There's all sorts of, there's like PTSD almost. You have guys that are pumped up on steroids and, you know, you have various rage incidents surrounding that. these players are hooked on painkillers a lot of the time because they take so much abuse and they need to be fed IVs full of painkillers in order to just keep going. So you combine all these factors together, and I don't really think it should be all that surprising that some of these guys are, you know, just going off, exploding, and hurting people that they should definitely not be hurting. And it's just, it's really sad, but you also wonder, just given the nature of this sport, given where a lot of the guys who play this sport come from, whether this is almost inevitable. I mean, it's extremely worrying, and the fact that the NFL didn't take it seriously until now and continues to not take it seriously, you know, just shows that this problem will probably continue.
I think that's a very good point, Nate. I think that part of what happens too is, I mean, these are people that are just being completely and totally valued for their physical ability, and it's like nothing else matters, you know? I mean, they become these sort of, I guess, vessels for physical feats, you know. They're basically, I mean, they're not even people, they're athletes, you know. It doesn't matter whether they're ethical. All that matters is that they can, you know, score a goal, or that they can, you know, get the ball where it's supposed to go. I mean, it ends up being a situation where yeah, it's like they aren't receiving the typical, you know, social rewards and social punishments for their behavior that everybody else receives. The only thing that's rewarded is their ability to play a game. You know, it's like an extreme version of that football saying, which is winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Well, yeah, in this case, we're talking about the game is just more important than everything else.
And they're treated like this starting at a very young age, too, high school, all through college. I mean, the center of the universe, they have all the power, and the sort of they're allowed to skate on a lot of sort of minor incidents, and I feel like this may build up a culture of entitlement, and you know, that's the kind of mindset you have to hit a woman if she's annoying you or something. Oh, just punch her, and you know, that'll solve it. I mean, it's an extremely selfish way to think, but I think the fact that some of these athletes grow up in a situation where pretty much they can do nothing wrong, and anything that they do wrong will be covered up and excused for them. I mean, I think that's the kind of mindset that they have, where it's, you know, they can do whatever they want. So if they want to hit a woman, they just will. They don't have that sort of self-control where they say, this is a terrible thing to do, and therefore I won't do it. It's just, that's sort of what they felt like doing at that moment. So if it was, you know, if it was okay all the other times before when they did, you know, things that would normally get them in trouble and in, you know, criminal legal trouble, that, oh, just do it again. Nothing happened before, so happening now. I still watch the NFL. I've been a fan for the past 20 years, but just because, or I mean, maybe 15, but just because you enjoy and watch a game, that means you have to be critical of it as well. And you know, if you have a familiarity with the league, it should be very easy to see, you know, how much of hypocrites and liars they're being right now. And it's the way that, okay, Adrian Peterson yesterday, he was excused from practice, but instead of saying, like, you know, he had a personal day, or, you know, so, oh, he had to go deal with his legal case for hitting his son, the coach is like, oh, he had a Veterans Day. What does that even mean? Like, that's what's code for beat their children, I guess. So I don't know. It's growing increasingly difficult to watch, I will say that. Between the flags, between the, you know, terrible, terrible problems that the league is going through, it's not the best time for the NFL.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, but then Arsenal for Democracy will be right back after that, so stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Michigan with me is Persephone. We're going to talk a little bit now about Syria, and specifically President Obama's new policy toward that. There's not a whole lot of new ground to cover, because Persephone and I, on the previous episode, or one of the recent episodes, did cover it in quite a bit of depth. I don't think our opinions have really changed very much. This is not a great policy, and it's not really going to solve anything. That's sort of our fundamental thesis there. There were two specific points, though, though, that I wanted to draw out of President Obama's speech and explain what I thought was a problem there that needed to be flagged. The first one is about this idea, and there was actually a Think Progress article also highlighting it, about the comparison that he made to Somalia and Yemen. These are two sites that he has conducted a whole bunch of airstrikes on during his presidency. I think George W. Bush started that as well in both of those countries, or at least in Somalia. Not mentioned was Pakistan, where President Obama dramatically increased and then eventually scaled back almost to none the airstrikes that were happening there. But Pakistan's a little bit of a different situation than Somalia and Yemen. I mean, arguably, it's actually a more apt comparison, but it's not the one that he made. So we're going to look at that. Basically, he was trying to use this as a comparison to reassure Americans, to say that this is not going to be, you know, Iraq 3.0 or whatever, that, you know, we're not sending combat troops in. This is a limited operation. It's an air operation. It's targeting specific terror targets. And so this was supposed to reassure everyone that it's going to be fine. You know, we've been doing this in Yemen and Somalia. As the article in Think Progress pointed out, in Yemen, we've conducted dozens and dozens of airstrikes over a period of time since about 2010 or so, especially after the situation with that Nigerian bomber who tried to blow up the plane that ended up going to Detroit, you know, and that was directed by American Anwar al-Awlaki in al-Qaeda in Yemen, essentially, or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There's a lot of close ties, actually, between Yemeni affairs and Somali affairs. That's something that goes back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. They're very close across the Red Sea from each other, so there's kind of a little bit of interplay there. And also, both of those conflicts in particular have heavy involvement by American Muslims. In the case of Somalia, that's because there's a lot of American Somalis, you know, people who are descended from Somali refugees who have gone back there to get involved because there's this big struggle for control in Somalia. But I don't see these as valid comparisons to the situation in Syria. To quickly recap that, basically, we've got a three-way civil war in Syria. There's the so-called moderate rebels. We'll get to that in a second. There's the Syrian government that's opposed by the United States. And there's ISIS, which is opposed by the United States. And ISIS and the Syrian government sort of were working together secretly, but then are no longer working together. And the Syrian government's been doing airstrikes on them. There's a lot of coverage of that on the arsenalfordemocracy.com blog, if you want more information on that. But essentially, Syria has said very clearly, we do not want American airstrikes, even on ISIS targets, without our cooperation and intelligence and consent. And you can say, well, who cares about the Syrian government, because we don't care what they liked either. And a year ago, we were about to bomb them if they hadn't done that deal with, you know, via Russia and everything with the chemical weapons. But the reality of the situation is that Syria has a functioning air force. It's not, you know, anywhere near as good as the U.S. Air Force, but it's not nothing. They have various air defense systems. They have a city and an air base in the middle of ISIS territory that they control. And they're saying that this will be considered a fundamental violation of sovereignty. Now, with Pakistan, you know, which I mentioned, that might be a more apt comparison. The government continually says, we didn't approve these airstrikes, they're violating our sovereignty. But then they allow drone bases in Pakistan and things like that. And there's various documents that come out in some of these leaks periodically saying that, no, in fact, the Pakistani government secretly gave permission for these airstrikes. That's just not the case with Syria. And the U.S. is making very clear that they won't be working with the Syrian government at all. We're having a lot of trouble coming up with anybody to back us, even our allies in the region, on these, you know, unilateral, outside the United Nations airstrikes against Syria. Russia, which also opposes ISIS and strongly backs the Syrian government, very opposed to this situation. And they're certainly, in the aftermath of the situation in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, they're not exactly looking to go through the UN Security Council for things these days. Which is a big turnaround from a year ago. But the reality is that we're going to be going into hostile territory to conduct these open-ended airstrikes that, similar to Yemen and Somalia, they haven't really solved the situation in either of those countries. But in the situations with Yemen and Somalia, at minimum, we had cooperation from the Yemeni government. We had cooperation from the Somali government when it existed, which is always questionable. You know, they're always in coordination with local authorities. In fact, the coordination was so strong and unpopular in Yemen that it helped bring down the Yemen government during the Arab Spring Revolution. But those airstrikes have continued, although at somewhat of a lesser rate. So that's kind of, you know, I don't see this as a great comparison in the first place, but I also don't see that as a reassuring comparison because those operations haven't really solved anything, and they're just really open-ended and seem to be just going on and on without any particular end in sight or plan. They're just periodically, you know, as the sort of offensive lingo goes with these drone strikes, you know, they're referred to as bug splats because that's what they look like on the screen. And of course, those are people dying. And a lot of them, as Greg and I have talked about on previous episodes, those are, you know, innocent people that are caught in the wrong place. But, you know, what are you going to do? Just have ongoing bug splats of ISIS leaders and their Humvees or whatever? Is that actually going to solve the problem? Probably not. And it's just widening this situation over the border from Iraq, where, you know, as Persephone and I talked about previously, that's about managing and containing the situation. This is now just widening it out and saying, oh yeah, we're going to go after these guys everywhere that they might be, anywhere, no matter what, with no limitations, no plan, no vision, no end in sight. I mean, how is that possibly supposed to be reassuring to us? Persephone, I want to get you in first on this. What was your reaction to this policy announcement, and also specifically this angle here with the Somalia and Yemen comparisons?
Well, I mean, it's clearly about emphasizing that, because, I mean, a big part of, you know, Obama's initial, of course, platform when running was, you know, ending the war in Iraq. And so I think that this announcement is about distancing this from that, and also about emphasizing that there will not be American soldiers, you know, fighting on the ground there. So his motives are pretty clear, but it's definitely not a very valid comparison. I mean, it's going to be a completely different situation. There's the risk of retaliation in the future, maybe not right now in the middle of the war, but, you know, at some point. It's not establishing a good relationship with whoever ends up ultimately in control, although I don't think that we necessarily want to be overly concerned. I don't think we need to be overly concerned with, you know, establishing like a friendship or whatever. I don't think that's realistic or a good idea, but we certainly don't want to be actively hostile to pretty much every side of this story.
Right. So, okay. So Persephone, looking at the long range retaliation prospects in general, you know, promoting anti-American sentiments and things like that, I think that's a pretty solid concern at this point. Nate, I don't know if you remember this, but in the 2011 operation, the NATO operation in Libya, that was Operation Odyssey Dawn, they were trying to put in a UN authorized no-fly zone against the Libyan government. And the first thing that they did in Libya was to take out all of the aircraft they could find that were on the ground, the Libyan aircraft, and also to take out radar defense detection systems and air defense systems in Libya. And the idea there was to prevent NATO planes from being shot down while maintaining this no-fly zone. Now, they're not saying they're going to have a no-fly zone in Syria, which I think is interesting because they basically don't want to prevent the Syrian government, even if they're not working with them, they don't want to prevent them from bombing these ISIS targets that they've started attacking. But, you know, what do you think about this idea that, unlike Somalia or Yemen, even if those governments, quote-unquote governments, opposed U.S. actions, they can't do anything about it. They can't hit back. What do you think that introduces a new dynamic here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is what differentiates these situations, or the current struggle against ISIS compared to, I guess, you know, al-Shabaab. You know, you have all the various militant groups, al-Qaeda in Yemen. It wasn't quite the same situation where you're facing up against a well-funded, well-disciplined paramilitary terrorist organization like ISIS, or a country with its own military like Syria. Although, Bill, I disagree with you a little bit that we're not, as you said in the opening, you know, sort of no end in sight, just no definition of the mission or anything like that. I think that there's certainly tremendous concerns about, you know, various types of mission creep and what the impact of this decision to have, you know, some sort of targeted operation against these groups and against Syria. So there's the various possibility that, you know, set off one thing and it leads to a sort of chain reaction that has profound impact in the region. You know, we saw that in Iraq. So I wouldn't say that it's completely well-defined or anything like that. But I also think that I think Obama learned his lesson pretty strongly in, getting out of Iraq, just no longer having to deal with the impact of U.S. troops being there. I think he's found in Afghanistan that it's not going nearly as smoothly as, you know, he probably would have wanted it to. And now he's looking at a situation where, you know, the current, I wouldn't say threat, but the strategic difficulties proposed by both Syria's sort of festering, simmering civil war and state failure and, you know, the rise of the Islamic State, these are actually fairly serious geostrategic events, would you say, Bill? They're not like an insignificant terror group in the desert. So.
They are, but I don't know that they're necessarily only defeatable by U.S. air power or whatever.
The thing is with the revolution in military technology that's happened over the past several decades, that we're now in a situation where you can, and this is one of the dangers of it, but it's so easy. It's so easy to just send some airstrikes, send some drones, send some, you know, cruise missiles, do whatever you need to sort of try to take out the command infrastructure or, you know, air defense systems of some of these groups. And, you know, I think it's very difficult for President Obama or any future American president to resist that temptation of just trying to snipe at some of these, clearly defined enemies. And, you know, you worry about pretty much, you know, we've seen, you know, in Pakistan try to blow up a Al-Qaeda leadership meeting and you hit a wedding. You know, there are all these incidents where these quote-unquote bug splats are, in fact, not nearly close to what they were intended to be, and you have innocent children and innocent villagers just being obliterated because they were mistaken for terrorists. So I think it's an extremely difficult situation, but I also don't think that we're completely rudderless here and that we're, you know, about to be sucked into a ground war with Syria and we're going to go back into Iraq and we're going to be sucked into another quagmire. I think this is going to be a situation kind of like the war on terror, where we're just sort of sniping at random people at all sorts of corners of the globe, and it's not clear when it's going to end, and it's not clear when, you know, what things are going to do. But it's also, we're not just throwing our troops necessarily wherever we can and then not, you know, having a plan to get them out.
Are we letting ourselves be dictated too much by basically desert dudes with swords chopping people's heads off periodically?
I mean, our foreign policy has been extremely reactionary over the past day. I mean, just 9/11, we didn't see that coming. And then our entire foreign policy for the next decade was, oh, we have to defeat the terrorists and kill bin Laden, and oh, Iraq too, because Iraq has somehow something to do with this. I don't exactly know how. It was never clear, but apparently we had to go to Iraq as well. So, it's reactionary, and, you know, Obama's, you know, still reactionary. But I think one of the reasons that Obama is acting like that is because he doesn't want to get sucked into another war. I mean, I think that was one of his things that he thought that should be part of his legacy. You know, from the Bush administration, my administration is trying to scale back America's military engagement. So I don't think he necessarily wants to do this. In fact, I don't really think he wanted to do Libya all that much, but there's sort of like an inexorable logic to the American military apparatus that these kind of things will happen almost regardless of who's the president, if that makes any sense. Like, I don't know. I'm not extremely worried at this point. If we start like in an ongoing, like months long air barrages, and, you know, then you got the military advisors, and then you got, you know, blah 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 blah. If that starts happening, I'll start growing very concerned. Right now, I think some drone strikes, some air strikes, I don't think that's necessarily going to be supremely inconvenient for the U.S. or getting the U.S. sucked deeply in. But it's definitely something to be pretty concerned about.
Now, we've already spent, I think, like $500 million on operations in Iraq just since June.
Yeah.
Persephone, what's your take on this inexorable, you know, the inevitability of American interventionism and the reactionary element?
I don't necessarily think that it's a good idea to talk in terms of inevitable. I think that that's certainly the direction things have been going, but I don't think that necessarily means that it's how things have to go. I think that the U.S. does often kind of end up sucked into these things because that's just where everybody turns and looks. But I don't think that that means that it is up to the U.S. to get physically involved in all these disputes. And there are certainly plenty of disputes that it does not get involved in.
Very quickly, before we end this segment, thoughts on this other part of his plan, the oft-cited, we're going to arm and train the moderate rebels, quote-unquote moderate rebels, in Syria, revitalizing that third side of the war that has almost completely been defeated at this point and has been driven back to Aleppo. Yeah, Free Syrian Army or various other things. I mean, Nusra Front, but I don't think we want to include them because they're Al-Qaeda affiliates who just kidnapped UN peacekeepers.
I mean, sure, arm and train them if you want them to come back in 10 years and use all the things that we provided them with against us.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's really proven that they exist or have any viable chance of doing anything. I think that war's over at this point.
Yeah, I feel like that was more like a couple months ago when they were not completely...
Or a couple years ago.
On their deathbed. Yeah, but when the arms started, Obama made that announcement, you could say that maybe he didn't move fast enough on that, whether you think that's a good idea or not. I mean, as Persephone just noted, there's always the chance that the student groups that you decide to fund kind of come back as the Taliban in a couple of years. So
that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Nate, thank you for being in studio with me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Persephone on the line, thanks for being here.
Anytime.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.